Well, we find trials, don't we, fascinating, the suspense and the drama of it all. I know Charles Dickens recorded quite vividly the judicial system in Victorian Britain, and, well, he has been read and read and reread, has he not? Fact or fiction, whether it's on the news, the 10 o'clock news, or on the radio, and it's a factual trial, a real trial that is happening, or just a fictional one, a drama or a video. Trials have captured the imagination, haven't they, of all of us in numerous different ways. We couldn't even imagine the media system, let alone the world, without a judicial system and without courts and trials. We would just absolutely fall apart, wouldn't we, into, well, just complete and utter anarchy if it wasn't for a judicial system and trials. And very often they do us a vast amount of good, and we should be very thankful for them. And the Bible even encourages us to pray for those that are part of the judicial system. But often, well, there are travesties of justice. And although this trial here recorded in front of us is a most fascinating trial to have a good look at, it is the biggest travesty of justice the world will ever, ever see. Trials, they have their twists and their turns, don't they? Are they guilty? Are they innocent? Are they telling the truth? Are they trying to get away with it? Will they go free or be condemned? And very often, if you get to do jury service, it's pretty mundane and ordinary and not greatly fascinating. But sometimes you get to do jury service and, well, it can be a really fascinating couple of weeks or longer. Christ's trial was a sensational trial. If it was today, it would be on every radio, internet site, TV channel, newspaper, and on the lips of the vast majority of the population of the world. The betrayal that we've already looked at, and the conspiracy behind the Pharisees that are pushing for this arrest. We have seen the arrest itself and Peter's denial three times after even being warned. But now we come to the trial with the prosecutors and the witnesses and the strategy of the defense, don't we? And then finally the verdict, the sentence, and we know it ends in an execution. But what we need to really do, if you really want to get the most out of this passage, and I think what Luke is really trying to impress upon us, Mark was writing to the Romans, and what he wants to impress upon us is just the suffering and the pain. Here is somebody who is really worthy to be your emperor, your king, your general, your leader. And he's writing to the Roman Empire and Roman people. And what he's really trying to impress Mark is upon his readers, you can follow this man. You can follow this man into battle. You can follow this man without reservation, because he is willing to suffer. He is willing to fight hand to hand, side to side, unto death himself. He is not somebody who's going to stand on the sidelines of your life and go tell you to do this, that, and the other without going through it himself. And that would really appeal to the Roman mindset. Well, what is Luke really trying to do? Although the sufferings are there, it's by no means listed out like Mark lists it out. I think what Luke is really trying for us to do is saying, to the Greek mind, and he's writing to the Greek mind, he's saying, you need to be a part of the jury. You really need to enter into this, and you need to really sit as part of the jury and really sift through the evidence, and you need to come to some conclusions yourself about who Jesus is, and, well, is he guilty or is he innocent? So that's what I really want you to do this morning as we go through some of the events. Pretend you are part of the jury. You can't ignore the verdict. The verdict that you give this morning, in actual fact, I'll say right from the outset, determines where you will spend eternity. So it's not like you are the jury who is going to make a decision that determines where Jesus is going to go and be. That's the huge mistake that these people made. We need to see ourselves as part of the jury, and the decision that we make, the verdict and the sentence that we give, so to speak, determines our future, not his. If he is guilty, if Jesus is guilty of blasphemy and leading a rebellion and trying to manipulate and twist and pervert and push humanity in a certain direction where he has no right to do so, he is an absolute madman, and really he does deserve to be crucified. We can forget him. And in my mind, I would just forget it and get on with life. For others, they've actually positively tried to resist him because the message of Christ, Christianity, and the church is actually bad for us as humanity. So if your verdict is guilty, you can either totally forget Jesus and just go on and live your life the way you want to live it, or, well, even positively resist him, as this message is actually bad for us as a species. If he is innocent, though, if he is innocent, well, then it condemns us all. And we are the guilty ones in need of him for our souls. Well, let's make our way through the details. And I hope that by the end of this morning, within half an hour or so, you will have, if you have not yet, made a very clear decision about who and what he is. You will pass sentence upon him, and you will respond appropriately this morning. We see him first before the soldiers, don't we? They were there, just there. They were there to hold prisoners so that they did not run or escape. But it turns out that they are allowed to have what they would call a bit of fun with him, and so they begin to do so. In the other Gospels, again and again, particularly in John, I think, he talks about drinking the cup that the Father has given to him. And he does pray in Luke's Gospel, doesn't he? Father, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but thy will be done. And he just has to drink down this cup of suffering and woe right down to its very dregs. Obviously, as he dies and as his body is separated from his soul upon the cross, he has finished drinking it. As he cries out, it is finished, and has nothing left to do but die. But he is now in the process, now from Gethsemane, really beginning to drink this cup of suffering and woe. The soldiers, well, there is no guilty verdict has been established whatsoever, but they are beating and mocking him as a guilty criminal already. And what is happening? We can read on the surface, but we need to look behind the surface and allow the rest of the Bible, if you like, to interpret what is happening here. What is happening in actual fact, he is being dehumanized. That's what's really happening. Man was originally created in the image of God and has fallen and has, well, dehumanized himself, and we are no longer what we really should, ought, and can be. But here is the real man, the wisest man, the best man, the perfect man, the sinless man. Here he is, the real epitome of what it means to be a human being. And he is being broken down and dehumanized. So much so that when Pilate brings him out, and with great irony, he says, "Behold the man." In actual fact, he is marred more than any man. His visage and image is taken away from him, and he actually would not be just unrecognizable to his disciples and his family and his friends. He would be unrecognizable as a human being. We're talking about an absolute pummeling and beating. Not so that he just looks a little bit beaten, not so that he is just unrecognizable to his friends and family, so that you would actually look and go, is that even really a human being that is left standing before us? And it really begins here when he is put into the hands of the soldiers. And as a sinless man, as the perfect man, as the just and the righteous man that we have been hearing about all the way through Luke's gospel, his sufferings would have been so enlarged and accentuated. People who have suffered physically much of their lives, emotionally and mentally, have been somewhat tormented and suffered throughout their lives. They become hardened to it and callous, don't they, to these things. People who are used to doing certain sports or whatever and injuring certain parts of their body, their bodies begin to get used to it and adapt to it, don't they? Those who are emotionally traumatized through much of their lives, they become hardened and callous to it, and it's a bit like, water off a duck's back, isn't it? Well, try to imagine the childhood and the upbringing that he had with Joseph and Mary. Try to imagine the kind of person he was, as Luke has portrayed to us who he was and what he was really like. He was the gentlest, the kindest, the nicest, the wholest person that has ever, ever lived. And so for any of us, even the most hardened amongst us, whether it's physically, mentally, or emotionally, it would be absolutely traumatic beyond words to describe for any of us. All of these things would be heightened and accentuated in Christ. Accentuated. And yet, Peter writes to us, he did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. And when he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judges justly or righteously. So as it all begins, there's not malice, as we see, and we're going to see. One of the things that he cries out on the cross, isn't it? One of the first things, forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. And there is this heart of love and of kindness and of patience and of gentleness. And he actually pities the men who are doing these things to him. And he looks to the Lord, his Father, committing himself to him and walking and living by faith as these things begin. Well, we see him before the soldiers and then mocking and beating him at the end of chapter 22. Then we see him before the Sanhedrin in verses 66 to 71. Contrary to the law, they are holding a trial while it is dark. That should not be happening at all. They wanted him executed before Passover and the Sabbath commenced. And so they are pushing forward, even willing, if you like, to work all night long to get the job done. Reminding us of the length that people will go to give an impression of respectability, though their hearts and intentions are bent upon evil and immorality. As I've already said, it's the greatest injustice that was ever committed. They are obviously seeking to execute an innocent man. And the historians and legal scholars have lists and lists and lists for us of the inconsistencies, the malpractice and the misconduct, the lies and the hypocrisy and the injustice of the whole thing. It's absolute travesty. And, there it is. Mark records for us, for many bore false witness against him, but their witnesses agreed not together. And it begins here, doesn't it, now, during the night time with the Sanhedrin. But Jesus cries out, doesn't he? And he cries out to them in verse 69 of chapter 22. Hereafter, the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. So although they think that they are judging him and he is, well, the defense, he is saying in actual fact, that is not really the case. The tables will be turned one day and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the throne of the Father. And so like today, many of us, we stand in judgment about Jesus and we feel that we have the final verdict about how we are to treat him. We decide his identity and his fate. But that is not the case, one bit of it at all. He reminds us from Psalm 110, he's already told us in Luke chapter 20, it's recorded. And David himself says in the book of Psalms, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit on my right hand and I will make thine enemies thy footstool. And it never occurred to them to really take seriously the very clear and repeated claims to be the King of Israel and their Messiah. For us, we can look at our Old Testament and we can see the multiple prophecies about where he was going to be born, when he was going to be born, what his enemies would do, what his friends would do, things that he would do that are just physically impossible, all of the miracles that he would do, so that we could be just abundantly clear and sure that this really is the Son of David, the promised King of Israel. But they never even thought to take these claims seriously at all. They wanted a military leader. They wanted somebody who was going to make them rich. They wanted somebody who was going to kick out the Romans, give them their liberty and their land and their prosperity and make their lives wonderful here, down here on earth. They didn't realize that the Messiah, their King, their Deliverer and Redeemer, was some who has come to bring everlasting life, riches, prosperity and freedom in our souls, hearts and in our lives. Well, he proclaims to them that he really is the Son of Man. He really is the Messiah. He really is the one who will sit upon the throne of the universe forever and forever. And well, that's it. Then they're gnashing their teeth, aren't they? We can kind of imagine the scenario. And well, what more further testimony do we need, they say. As soon as it is day, so as soon as the sun is coming up, Luke is saying, like a bunch of pack of ravenous wolves, they press in now to drag him to Pilate and for the kill. He's been physically, mentally, and emotionally traumatized through that evening, and well, with no rest, like a pack of wolves pressing in for the kill, they drag him as soon as it is legally right, as soon as Pilate is willing to listen to them at all, they drag him along to Pilate. They hated him, completely illogical, irrational, completely unreasonable. But they hated him because he was popular, and they coveted and they longed for that popularity. For them, popularity brought power, prestige, reputation, money, and position. And so they were jealous of him. Pilate even records that they were doing these things because of jealousy. And so because they were moved by jealousy, their power and their prosperity is being threatened by Jesus. And so all rationality, all justice, is all reasonableness is all thrown out of the window now. And they, well, take him to Pilate. He has been exposing their hypocrisy, hasn't he? And their secrets. And that's what Jesus does. Like nobody else. Like nobody else, he stares us right in the face. He looks right down into our minds, into our hearts, our desires and everything. And he exposes all of our hypocrisy and our secret sin. So unless we're willing to humble ourselves and turn to him, we will just naturally shy and turn and run away from him. But because he threatened their whole lifestyle, threatened their prosperity, he threatened their power, he threatened everything that they loved and had, they had and wanted to do away with him. Well, we see him before the soldiers, we see him before Pilate for the first time, before the Sanhedrin for the first time. Now they send him off to Pilate at the beginning of chapters 23. The Jewish court is under Roman authority. They can fine, they can beat, they can imprison, but they cannot execute. They cannot give a sentence of death. So if they had the power to do it, they would have stoned him there and then on the spot. But they don't have the power to do so. And obviously, unjustly executing somebody would cause all manner of problems. So they have to go through the Roman governor. A Roman governor is the only one who has the authority and right to pass the death sentence and to legally sign a death warrant. So they bring him before Pilate. Pilate, he loved the seaside. I can kind of relate. He liked the sun. He liked the sand. And so he normally lived down by the coast in Caesarea. The easy life down there, away from Jerusalem, away from all the problems and this, that and the other. And I can really relate to what Pilate did in making Caesarea his home. But because you've got 500,000 extra people or so coming up into Jerusalem and the possibilities of all kinds of problems, the story of revolutionaries possibly gathering people together there in Jerusalem, and the nightlife would have been good, and the bribery and the corruption and the meeting up with everybody else and everything, Pilate just can't miss it, can he? So he is drawn to Jerusalem at the Passover for multiple different reasons. But they can't tell Pilate that he is a blasphemer, the Son of God and the Son of Man. Pilate would have shrugged his shoulders and said, it's some kind of shallow, trite, superficial thing to me. We're all sons of God, aren't we? And if he thinks he's some kind of special person, divine or whatever, that's all very good and wonderful. Pilate was a pagan. He had many, many gods. And so for some human being to say that he was the Son of God and the Son of Man was no big deal to Pilate whatsoever. And he just wouldn't have even countenanced or listened to any of it. So with the injustices continuing, they twist it, don't they? They turn it around. They don't come to him. The charge that they've got him on guilty as is blasphemy, saying he's the Son of God and the Son of Man. But then they completely change the entire thing and they go to Pilate accusing him of three things, don't they? They accuse him of political crimes. Now, we found this fellow perverting our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king. And in verse 5 it says, but they were the more fierce, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee, to this place in Jerusalem. So they're going for political crimes now, aren't they? He stirs up the people all the way down from Galilee down to Judea, and here he's stirring the people up. He's trying to gather an army together to fight against you. He's telling the people not to pay taxes to Caesar. And they've hit the nail on the head there, because Romans, you start talking about taxes and rebellion and the like, and any Roman is instantly going to start listening. The Romans cared a little more for anything else but taxation and the threat of revolutionaries. So Pilate really has to listen at this point. Pilate gives the verdict, though. He speaks with him and he says to them in verse 4, I find no fault with this man at all. Now, Pilate isn't a lover of the Jews at all. In actual fact, it's recorded in chapter 13 that he'd killed a number of Jews and mingled their blood with the offering as just a sign of total contempt and hatred for the Jewish people. They were constantly butting heads and they were a real thorn in Pilate's side. And yet, it doesn't seem to make any difference to him, Barabbas or Jesus. What does it really matter? And yet he just knows that it's because of jealousy. He knows that this is completely unjust. And he begins at this point to really try to defend Jesus and say, no, he is innocent. And other gospels make much of the fact that Pilate really did believe that Jesus was innocent and should be set free. Well, hearing that he was a Galilean, that really was good. I can wash my hands of this. I can pass the buck, send him over to Herod. Hopefully Herod can deal with this and they won't send him back and it's the end of it and I can get on with my day. It hasn't begun very well, but maybe hopefully it'll get a little bit better as I just get rid of them and Jesus, send him over to Herod, and hopefully Herod can sort the whole thing out. So now from verse 8 onwards, he's sent on to Herod. Herod, we have heard, longed and desired to see him. Herod was the man who had beheaded John the Baptist, and then when Jesus came doing miracles, thought that, well, as people were saying, that John the Baptist has been raised from the dead, and he heard about the miracles and everything else, and Herod is really pleased to see Jesus. He is hoping that he will have some private show, that Jesus will do some miracle or something, and entertain this worldly man, Herod. His curiosity is going to be satisfied and he will be entertained in a worldly sense. But Jesus is not here to perform tricks at the whims of men or answer our frivolous questions at all. You see, Jesus is about wisdom, isn't he? About truth. About repentance and obedience. About knowing and following God and having the hope of everlasting life. Jesus is a man of joy. He wants to give us joy, he wants to give us peace, he wants us to know the love of God in our lives, yet those things are abundantly true. But he wants us to know about serious things, real things, eternal things, meaningful things. Whereas this Herod, all he wants is a few tricks and a bit of worldly entertainment in the morning. He is not bothered about his soul. He is not bothered about his eternity. He is not bothered about salvation at all and forgiveness, which Luke has written to us again and again. He just wants nice feelings, entertainment at this point. There is no desire at all to repent or humble himself, take up his cross and follow Jesus. And sadly, shockingly, Jesus remains silent. Now, it tells us in the book of Isaiah that like a lamb is silent before his shearers, so he will be silent before his accusers. But what is shocking to me is that when Jesus is face to face with the devil, Jesus will talk with the devil. But when he's face to face with this man, he refuses to speak to him. And that to me is a very, very solemn and serious thing.
that Jesus is willing to countenance and respond to the fallen angel, the devil himself. But in front of this man who is so far fallen, who has just completely rejected his need of a savior, has completely rejected the whole concept of truth and wisdom and reality, and thinks that his whole life is about money and pleasure and self-interest, and his heart and his soul has become so callous and fallen that even when he does get to speak to God incarnate, the Son of Man, he is so far fallen that Jesus remains silent. And there have been cases of those who are absolute enemies of Jesus and have worked much of their lives and given much energy to the destruction of the church and the Bible and the Word of God. And when they've been on their deathbeds, they have realized that it really is more than likely, probably true. And they have in their desperation been crying out, and it's as if heaven has been silent to them. Well, Herod is given the silent treatment by the Son of God. And he is beaten for it, and again he is drinking down more of this cup that he has been given to drink. And in verse 11 it tells us, then Herod with his men of war treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. So he's back to Pilate now for the second round. And here we see lots of different people, don't we? See lots of different people, whether it's Judas, whether it's the Sanhedrin, whether it's Pilate, whether it's Herod, and now back to Pilate. And in Pilate, we see somebody who is facing the truth, who is contemplating the truth, and yet rejects it. That's a warning to us, isn't it? We are warned not to be like Judas. We've had a warning, don't be like Peter. We have a warning, don't be like those soldiers. Don't be like the Sanhedrin. Don't be like Herod. But here we have another person here. And he's saying, here is somebody. Here's not somebody who is absolutely living for pleasure like Herod is. Jesus is willing to countenance him and respectfully answer him. But here we have somebody who's facing the truth, contemplating, hearing the truth, and yet rejects the truth. The truth is hard to accept. Fair enough. Jesus tells us, count the cost. There's going to be changes in your family. There's going to be changes in the workplace. There's going to be changes in your behavior. There's going to be changes what you're going to be doing with your time and life on a Sunday from now on. There is going to be changes in your life, some uncomfortable changes maybe in your life. Jesus says that the epitome of Christianity really is repenting, taking up your cross, denying yourself, and following me. That's something that Luke records again and again. For Luke, Christianity is taking up your cross, denying yourself, and following Jesus Christ on a daily and a weekly basis. It's a challenge, isn't it, to our position, to our comfort, to our pride, to our lifestyles and our future. It's a monumentous decision to follow Jesus. It is no light, shallow thing at all. It will impact every aspect and area of your life. Now, sometimes people come when they're young, and in the grace and in the mercy of God, they come somewhat naively. They are somewhat repentant and they do acknowledge that Christ is the King. But when we come later on in our lives, there is monumentous decisions that we need to think about. What we watch and don't watch is going to come under scrutiny. How we spend our money and not is going to come under scrutiny. How we live and spend our Sundays is going to come under scrutiny. But here is a man who is faced with the truth, considers the truth, and throws it all away. Well, finally, Jesus is before the nation now, isn't he? As Pilate has done everything he can to release this man, he says, I'm even willing to chastise him and scourge him. And many people would have died in that process. I'm even willing to kind of put him in that position, scourge and chastise him, and then set him free, just to appease you somewhat. But the priests, the Pharisees have stirred up the nation now, and they're not happy with that. They're not happy with him being brought within a hair's breadth of his life, maybe, and possibly dying in a scourging. They want to secure a crucifixion and a hanging upon a tree. See, to the Jews, the Old Testament says he who hangs upon a tree is accursed. And their mindset is that somebody who calls himself the Messiah hanging on a tree will not be accepted by any Jew. He is totally cursed. He is cast off from God. He is the person who has no blessing from God whatsoever. He could never be received and accepted by any Jewish mind as the Messiah. So they're pushing for crucifixion and an execution upon the tree. Barabbas really was a revolutionary, really was guilty of murder, and they loved him more than Jesus. Ironically, Plato, a number of hundred years before these events, said this. He tried to imagine the perfect man, a just man in his simplicity and nobleness, willing to hold on to his course of justice, unwavering to the point of death. Plato wrote this long before Jesus ever came. They were Greeks, and they were trying to personify the perfect man, come up with the perfect ideal, and then become that kind of a person. The great philosopher could well imagine what would happen to such a man in this wicked world. Plato writes, "Our just man will be thrown into prison, scourged and racked, will have his eyes burnt out, and after every kind of torment be impaled upon a tree." You see, Pilate knew something of our makeup. He knew something of our psychology. He knew something of what we were as human beings. And as a Greek philosopher, he tried to imagine the perfect man, the just man, the ideal man that Luke is portraying Jesus to be. And Plato realized, because of the hypocrisy, because of the injustices that are within each and every one of our hearts, if a perfect, just, noble man came into the world, this is what we would do with him. We couldn't bear him. We couldn't bear with him exposing our hypocrisy and secret sins. We couldn't bear him telling us how to live perfectly. We would far rather shrink away, love the darkness rather than the light. So he wasn't a prophet, but very perceptively he could see what we would do with the perfect man if he was to come into the world. And now everybody is crying out for blood. Whether it's the people who are crying out, "Crucify him, crucify him," whether it's the priests that are stirring up and very vociferously and viciously are pushing Pilate and Herod for a crucifixion, whether it's Pilate himself who just shrugs his shoulders and hands them over to his will, we are told, well, ultimately, it is every man's will that he is crucified, and in actual fact, it is God the Father's will that he is crucified as well. Jesus is the most innocent man that has ever lived. His friends all said he was sinless. He was without sin. He committed no sin. Paul, the great and huge New Testament theologian, he can say without doubt that he committed and did no sin at all. Now, they understood what sin was. They understood what imperfection was. They understood the law of God. And that is a monumentous statement to say that there is a man without sin. And for Peter and for John and the writer of the book of Hebrews as well to, well, back that up is no small statement. He is not only innocent, he is the sinless man, the only man that has lived and died without ever committing a sin. But like for Barabbas, he goes as a substitute. Try to imagine yourself as Barabbas. Barabbas deserved the cross. That's where he should have been. He committed murder. He'd been telling people not to pay taxes. He was a revolutionary stirring up the people. And so he should have been crucified on that day. There were two other men, weren't there, with Jesus who deserved to be crucified. They were robbers, and they even themselves admit and confess that they deserved to be where they were. But Jesus doesn't. And like in a sense he goes in the place of Barabbas as a substitute, he has gone in the place of all those that would receive and accept him. You can turn round and you could say this morning, if you're not a Christian, if I was there and if I was part of the jury, I would say he is innocent and I don't want him crucified. I'd rather Barabbas, I'd rather the Sanhedrin, I'd rather Pilate, I'd rather Herod, I'd rather Peter, I'd rather anybody else but him. You may not want him, but you do need him to be your substitute. And so as we close this morning, what will you do with Jesus? What will you do with Jesus?
There's a painting in Florence by a famous artist, Cicero, called Ecce Homo, Behold the Man in Latin. And in the picture you can see Jesus in the background, but you can see Pilate with his arms outreached in front of the people. You see the back of Pilate, and he's reaching out to the crowds and the masses in the painting. And he's basically, the painting is saying, what would you have me to do with Jesus? And the crowds are crying, crucify him. But you're part of the jury here this morning, and the challenge is to each and every one of us this morning, isn't it? What will you do with Jesus? When you consider his claims and his defense, what is your verdict? Will you push him about? Will you try to beat and mock, humiliate and dehumanize him like the soldiers? That's what a lot of people are doing today, isn't it? Trying to slur and say all manner of things about him, dehumanizing him, belittling him. They would beat him physically if they had the chance. Sure, there's no one like that here this morning. The Sanhedrin saw Jesus as nothing more than a political pawn to push about in a game of power, self-interest and politics, and lots of church leaders throughout the world are doing that. Jesus is a political pawn in their power struggle and their self-interest. For Herod, he's nothing more than an entertainer, someone to satisfy his curiosity. For Pilate, he faced, considered, and rejected the truth. But it is not us who give the verdict and the sentence. It is really us who are on trial today. It is really us who will on the last day be tried by him. And your decision today does not depend where he will be, does not depend his fate, does not depend his identity and dictate these things. But your decision may well be determined where you will spend eternity. He was raised for our justification, Paul tells us, that we might be forgiven and righteous before God. He is received by repentant faith. And my closing question is, are you ready? Are you ready for the trial of your life? Jesus has been tried, the innocent man found guilty and sentenced to execution upon a cross. Jesus was the Son of God and he was right. And the Father said, no, my verdict is that he is the Son of God. And he raised him from the dead so that we could be no longer guilty, forgiven and right with God. What is your verdict on Jesus Christ today? Well, we're going to close and we're going to sing together now. We're going to sing 224. 224. What grace, O Lord, and beauty shone around your steps below. What patient love was seen in all your life and death of woe. 224.